on certain food items. €330 million has been announced to support Ukrainian farmers.
They need, for the spring sowing campaign, they need 50,000 tons of fuel per week.
Animal feedstocks are on the decline. Campaigners say millions could starve in East Africa if EU leaders don't do more to help poorer nations. Syria and Yemen have also been singled out for needing special support.
There are, in fact, 14 low-income countries which depend for more than 50% of their wheat imports on these two countries, on Ukraine and Russia.
The European Commission has presented new legislation to make it mandatory for member states to ensure 80% gas reserves are put in place before November. Experts say that is wishful thinking. 3.5 million Ukrainian refugees have now arrived in the EU. Most countries in the bloc have failed to take in their fair share, but some already have.
Poland is in top. The country number two is Austria. The country number three is Cyprus. Country number four is Czech Republic.
Almost €3.5 billion has been set aside from the EU budget to support refugees, including 1,470 unaccompanied children who have arrived in the bloc from Ukraine. Some nations are saying it's simply not enough money. EU leaders will hold a summit here on Thursday and Friday to consider, amongst other things, a request from Poland for new funding towards the cost of dealing with the growing refugee crisis. All indications so far suggest that request will be rejected. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Over the past week in France, social unrest has been a near daily occurrence, but it may be an everyday issue now and until after the presidential election. Public transport unions in Paris have called an unlimited strike starting March 25th over rampant inflation. Reduced purchasing power was the number one election issue in 2017 and 2012, but the unrest in Ukraine and the European Union's response to it has sent costs haywire. The increases arrive after a decade of right-wing austerity measures, which suppressed wages, reduced social services, and decreased job stability, leaving the average person especially vulnerable to record-high prices. Across the nation, unions were already protesting in an immediate response to President Emmanuel Macron's promise to raise the retirement age to 65. It's a bold gambit, given how unpopular such a change would be. But Macron appears to be betting that polls are correct and that he'll win re-election.
Plenty of people died before the age of 65. Can they never retire? Plenty of workers have physically demanding jobs and are poorly paid. Should they live in poverty and work until their death as well? 65 is way too late, and it's another step too far by Macron.
Austerity, then the coronavirus, now the Ukraine-related instability. Many say France is on the brink of a return to yellow vest levels of unrest if more far-right economic policies are demanded of the average person, but not of the rich.
Raising the retirement age is a certain way to reduce the number of available jobs. So from an economic point of view, not only would this not solve our unemployment problems, but it will actually be counterproductive. Macron is doing things from a purely ideological perspective and not at all with a view of helping the people of France.
France's presidential election has been dominated by disinterest. Voters have tuned out a campaign which was based on Islamophobia and xenophobia, and then the unrest in faraway Ukraine. Many wonder if Macron's call to raise the retirement age may have awoken a sleeping giant, the French public.
France seems to be ignoring or has forgotten about the presidential election, but regular protests are reminding the country of the long-running domestic issues which France still faces. Some of the answers may be fought out in the streets over the next month. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
A delegation from the International Academic Campaign Against Occupation and Apartheid headed to the offices of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, OHCHR, as well as the UN Special Coordinator's Office, UNSCO, in Gaza. They handed the memorandum on Israeli apartheid signed by around 70 international organizations, human rights networks, academics, and researchers from 45 countries. The campaign is calling on the United Nations and Western countries to impose sanctions on the Israeli regime for its occupation of the Palestinian territories and its apartheid regime. The Israeli regime is an occupying power and has kept the Gaza Strip under a crippling blockade since 2007 and also waged four wars on the tiny enclave.
We are here to condemn Israeli apartheid, and we call on the international community to support the Palestinian people. We also demand and end the Israeli crimes. Israeli leaders must face justice for their crimes against the Palestinian people.
Tel Aviv also practices apartheid policies against Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Among Israel's apartheid policies is the demolition of Palestinian homes in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds. Israel also keeps thousands of Palestinian prisoners in its jails under inhumane detention conditions. Israeli forces also use excessive force to kill and maim peaceful Palestinian protesters in the blockaded Gaza Strip as well as in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
Today we are here to prove that the crimes of the occupations against the Palestinians and the prisoners must be documented and to support the Palestinians to obtain their rights.
Last month, at least 277 human rights groups and civil society organizations around the world denounced Israeli officials for imposing apartheid on Palestinians.
Observers say that Israel's apartheid against Palestinians is a cruel system of domination that constitutes a crime against humanity. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus heading a high-ranking delegation. He met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed the implementation of bilateral cooperation agreements. Talks covered cooperation in fighting terrorism, in which Abdullahian renewed Iran's support to Syria for the full liberation of all its territories. The top diplomat briefed President Assad on the Vienna talks on the revival of the JCPOA. Assad hailed Iran for adhering to principles and rights in the track adopted during the negotiations. He asserted that reaching a deal has become more important in service of Iran and the region's interest as well as international equilibrium.
We had good meetings with President Assad and Foreign Minister Faisal Maqdad. We welcome the new approach by some Arab states in restoring relations with Syria. We reaffirmed Iran's readiness to develop relations with Syria and discuss increasing the level of tourist exchange. We hope that in the near future, the presidents of both countries would meet.
A separate meeting was also held between the foreign ministers of Syria and Iran. Focus was laid on the notable increase of trade exchange and means of overcoming the impact of economic sanctions on the two countries.
We discussed means of confronting unilateral illegal sanctions on both states, as well as developments currently happening in the meetings of the Syrian Constitutional Committee in Geneva. Syria and Iran's stances are identical in this regard. We are in favor of a successful result. However, the other side is not working for national interests.
Syria was the first destination of the regional tour of the Iranian delegation, which also includes Lebanon. Abdullahian's visit is one of many exchanged between both countries' officials. It signals the extensive and continuous cooperation between the two allies at all times, which resulted in a defeat of terror in Syria and currently aims to boost economic partnerships. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Poland's support for fellow Europeans fleeing Ukraine is receiving much praise. However, this has been a huge turnaround, for in past years, the Eastern European country has been heavily criticized for a proud anti-immigration stance, particularly hostile towards Muslim refugees.
Angela Merkel started this madness, and now this is a problem about Muslims mainly coming to Europe.
Amid the anti-Islam rhetoric, Press TV decided to investigate how local Muslims live under these types of challenges.
The Muslim community that lives here in Poland is small but very passionate. It's estimated somewhere between 25 to 40,000 Muslims currently live in the country, making up about 0.1% of the current population, as it's estimated. The majority of them are native Tatars, but also there has been an immigration of Muslims to Poland from various countries. We've come here to one of the main mosques in the capital, Warsaw, to meet the community firsthand.
The imam explained that his main focus has always been to re-educate Poles about Islam and demonstrate Islamic teachings through good deeds.
We teach Quran, we teach Arabic language, and we teach something about Islam. Yes. During Ramadan, because Ramadan is near now, we're making soon 1992, we're making food and iftar for everybody. Every day. From time to time, also, we're making open day. This is for non-Muslims to come to our mosque to hear something and listen about Islam. We made in March open day, and during this activity, 5 women accept Islam.
Despite these successes, Islamophobia still rears its ugly head from time to time. But the mosque uses Islam to combat this also.
One time only, the Polish youth came in front of this masjid and said some bad words about Islam. But I went to them and invited them to here to take a cup of tea, and they became friendly.
In past years, it was Islamic immigration that was considered the major threat in Eastern Europe. Now it's Russia. But conflict in Europe has historically catapulted dangerous ideologies into the forefront. Muslims in Europe look on with caution. Robert Carter, Warsaw.
Yemen's Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has held a press conference in the capital Sana'a to release its latest statistics of 7 years of Saudi Arabia's war and siege on its neighboring Arab country. The report says more than 46,000 civilians have been killed or injured, including women and the children.
During 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition committed horrific crimes amounting to genocide. There were 46,262 civilians who got killed and wounded as a result of the direct targeting of the Saudi-led coalition's aircraft, including more than 8,000 children and 5,000 women. There is also systematic destruction and targeting of service and economic infrastructure, and the Saudi coalition's air force continues to target roads, bridges, and civilian objects to this day.
The report says more than 500,000 homes were destroyed due to Saudi Arabia's air attacks and thousands of families were displaced. Also, the figures show further destruction of the country's infrastructure.
For 7 years, Saudi Arabia has committed war crimes against Yemeni civilians, but unfortunately, the international community did not fulfill its duty to stop these crimes. Therefore, we see today the Yemeni army intensifying its operations against Saudi territories, and this is a legitimate right, as it is self-defense.
Since the beginning of the war, Saudi Arabia has clearly violated international law multiple times by targeting residential areas across Yemen using cluster munitions. However, this has not pushed the international community to take any measures against Riyadh's war crimes.
After 7 years of killing and destruction in Yemen, observers say Saudi Arabia has not achieved any of its announced goals. On the contrary, Riyadh is facing more retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni forces deep inside its territory. Abu Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the second OIC conference Pakistan hosted in 3 months. In December, foreign ministers from the OIC held an extraordinary session to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. But the latest session was a regular one with an ambitious agenda on the table. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan opened the conference while regretting how the OIC failed both the people of Palestine and Kashmir.
We have failed both the Palestinians and the people of Kashmir. I'm sad to say that we have been able to make no impact at all. They don't take us seriously. We are a divided house, and those powers know it.
For the first time, the Chinese foreign minister attended the OIC conference as a special guest. In his speech, Wang, he said Beijing wants to work closely with the Islamic countries.
China stands ready to work with the Islamic countries to actively advocate true multilateralism, safeguard the purposes and principles of the UN Charter, uphold the UN-centered international system.
The issue of Ukraine also came up for discussions. The OIC Secretary General stressed the need for political solution to the crisis, as he feared the conflict would endanger international peace and stability. The OIC conference coincided with Pakistan Day celebrations. The delegates also attended the National Day parade.
The two-day conference concluded with OIC members adopting over 100 resolutions. But observers believe that Islamic countries representing 1.5 billion people need to make a difference through actions, as mere statements are not enough. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Cartoons often have the power, by drawing attention quickly and getting straight to the point, to uncover deceit and deliver uncomfortable, shocking messages. In a span of over 25 years since the early 60s, late Palestinian cartoonist Naji al-Ali produced over 40,000 drawings and several books of cartoons, raising awareness on the Palestinian plight at the hands of Israeli settlers and harshly criticizing Arab regimes and the U.S. imperialistic policies. Today, a book containing tens of cartoons by al-Ali has been published for the first time in Italy.
We have published this book because presently the Palestinian struggle has been put on hold. Nobody talks about it anymore, but the Israeli occupation continues and the elimination of an entire population is ongoing. Ali and his character, Handala, serve as an example of how a cartoon can be more useful than an intifada to stop the occupation and lift the veil of lies covering Palestine.
Naji al-Ali's most famous character is Andala, a 10-year-old barefoot child dressed in ragged clothes. The boy, always drawn from behind while watching all the bad that is happening on earth, has over time become a symbol of the Palestinian resistance, giving voice to the poor and oppressed. This year marks the 35th anniversary of the assassination of Andala's creator Naji al-Ali, as he was murdered outside a newspaper office in the UK in 1987. 5 years ago, London's police department reopened its investigation into the unsolved murder of the Palestinian political cartoonist.
Naji al-Ali's work was for a long time reflective of the Palestinian cause. His cartoons were very critical of everybody involved in the Palestinian plight. Andala means bitter in Arabic and well represents the struggle of the Palestinians. The fact that the boy was drawn from behind meant that everybody, including the Arabic world, had turned their back to Palestine. Al-Ali's assassination was plotted by dark powers, certainly close to the Mossad.
Naji al-Ali's book was recently launched in Naples. It will also be presented in several other Italian cities, including Rome, Genoa, and Bologna. Max Civili, Rome.
On World Water Day, water pollution has reached an alarming level in the besieged Gaza Strip. The enclave's coastal aquifer is almost completely polluted with various contaminants. The groundwater in Gaza has high levels of nitrates and other dangerous pollutants, with contamination levels 3 times higher than international standards for safe drinking water. The Israeli regime has imposed tight restrictions on the entry of badly needed equipment to maintain water and sewer systems and targeted them during wars.
Today, about 98% of our municipal water wells, drinking water wells, their water quality does not fit with the WHO standards related to the drinking water standards.
In recent years, Gaza municipalities were forced to pump untreated raw sewage directly into the sea due to lack of electricity for treatment plants. Raw sewage seepage into the ground has worsened the water crisis. Palestinian officials say Israel has for years deprived residents of Gaza of healthy water supply and stolen their underground resources.
Israel tried to steal our groundwater by having their pumping wells along the eastern border of Gaza Strip and preventing the flow of groundwater by gravity, by lowering the water table and reverse the direction of the groundwater at that location.
The Israeli blockade and wars have taken their toll on Gaza's water infrastructure. Experts say the tiny seaside sliver is currently in a chronic state of water emergency.
Gaza is suffering due to the water catastrophe with full meaning. Shortage of water, and at the same time we have polluted water. We are calling on the international community in order to end this blockade, which is one of the main reasons for such catastrophe that we are living in.
According to human rights organizations, depriving people of water supplies is a clear breach of international law.
On World Water Day, experts say that the complete lifting of the Israeli blockade is the first step towards easing the water crisis in the coastal enclave. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Congratulations to all Iranians and everyone who celebrates the ancient festivity of Nowruz.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Yemen marks the seventh anniversary of the Saudi-led war on the country. On March 26, 2015, Saudi Arabia launched the bloody war against Yemen in collaboration with a number of its allies and with arms and logistics support from the U.S. and several Western states. Riyadh and its allies also imposed an all-out blockade on Yemen. The objective was to return to power the former Riyadh-backed regime headed by Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi and to crush the popular Ansar resistance movement. However, the war has stopped well shy of all of its goals despite killing hundreds of thousands of Yemenis and turning Yemen into the scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
As the world's eyes are on the Russia-Ukraine conflict, the Saudi-led war in Yemen is still taking the lives of more civilians and pushing the country to the brink of famine. A recent UN report says 17.4 million Yemenis are food insecure, and the number is likely to go up to 19 million by the end of the year.
Unfortunately, the United Nations reports did not clarify the main reason for the deterioration of the humanitarian situation in Yemen, which is the blockade imposed by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The only solution to end the humanitarian crisis is to lift the siege and allow Yemenis to import food and medicine.
Back in 2015, Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a deadly war in Yemen to bring back to power former President Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi. Hundreds of thousands of people, including women and the children, have lost their lives since then.
I was sitting in my house with my children in the evening, and suddenly a missile struck the next house. The explosion destroyed my house as well. We were so afraid.
Saudi warplanes targeted our neighborhood. Look at the destruction. This is a crime, and unfortunately, the words wash in silence.
The Saudi war has impacted all aspects of civilian lives in Yemen, including the healthcare system, which is on the verge of collapse. This comes amid the ongoing fuel shortage, as Saudi Arabia keeps detaining Yemeni oil ships despite the fact that the vessels have UN permits.
We suffer from a severe lack of fuel. We cannot operate medical devices without electricity, not to mention the lack of medicines and medical solutions. There is overcrowding in the medical centers. Unfortunately, the United Nations did not provide us with anything other than media statements. The international community must stop Saudi Arabia from seizing Yemeni oil ships.
Children are the most affected people by Saudi Arabia's war. The rate of child malnutrition is one of the highest in the world, and the situation continues to deteriorate.
More than a million children are suffering from malnutrition in Yemen, and I believe the number is greater than this. And we are coming to a worse period because we do not have the most basic needs necessary to save the lives of sick children, such as milk, solutions, and medicines.
Observers say the years-long Saudi war in Yemen has only created the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis. They say years of failure should be enough for Riyadh to start looking for other means to get rid of the quagmire it is stuck with its war in Yemen. Al-Latif al-Washali, Sana.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have Yemeni activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, joining us from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. And with us from San Francisco, Mr. Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Becker in San Francisco. Why did the Saudis start this war from a political and from an economic perspective? What were Riyadh's objectives? There have been different reasons circulating among analysts. What are your views on that?
Well, I think that there are a number of objectives that Saudi Arabia has, but I think the fundamental one is to be the unquestioned dominant power in the entire region. The people of Yemen have suffered a lot from the policies of Washington and Riyadh and the UAE and the UK, all of them. And yet, we see if we go back even to the time of the first Gulf War, I remember in August of 1990 when Cuba and Yemen deferred from voting for the sanctions against Iraq at the beginning of that crisis, and the U.S. Revoked. They said at the Security Council, the U.S. representative said to the Yemeni representative, "That's the most expensive vote you'll ever make. $70 million in aid was taken away." And then I believe a million Yemenis or something along some number like that were expelled from Saudi Arabia, where they do a lot of the work. And of course, Saudi Arabia, like UAE and Bahrain, it's the foreign workers who have no rights and no status who do the work.
Hossein Al-Bukhaiti in Sana'a, is Saudi Arabia any closer to its goals now than it was 7 years ago when they instigated this deadly war?
I think one of their main goals was, as they say, to eliminate Ansarullah, or as they call them, the Houthis, to stop them from threatening Saudi Arabia. There was no threat from Ansarullah here in Sana'a towards Saudi Arabia. It was Saudi who have actually now created one of the largest and biggest threat against Saudi Arabia. And of course, the other goal that the Saudis said at the beginning of the war, that they have destroyed 85% to 90% of what they say strategic weapons like ballistic missile and others who used to be in the hand of the previous Ali Abdullah Saleh regime. They have not succeeded, and we have seen the latest attack that happened today. And as well, they say they want to bring Hadi back to Yemen. And on that issue as well, we see that Hadi government still taking refuge in Riyadh. And I think there is a goal that the Saudi has not declared. They want actually to divide Yemen. They want to separate Yemen. They want to dominate Yemen by implementing U.S. Foreign policy in Yemen, as it was in many countries, like in Afghanistan and in Libya. But in this way as well, they have as well failed. And I believe that if Yemeni army will... and as well, just today, Sayyid Abdul Malik Al-Houthi have said that the Saudi want to make Yemenis suffer, and they are torturing Yemen because they want to bring Yemeni to their knees. They want Yemeni to surround them. That's why the blockade has been since the beginning of the war. And Saudi want to use the humanitarian issue and disaster that happens in Yemen. They think that they can use it as a pressure on Sana'a government. But on the other hand, we see that more Yemenis actually are joining the fight, because they say if we will die either from hunger in our home or by Saudi constant airstrike, they will better die while fighting Saudi Arabia.
Richard Becker, how do you assess the impact that this war has had both for the Saudis and for other countries in the region?
Well, I mean, the greatest impact, of course, is on the people of Yemen. It was estimated last fall, the UN predicted that by the end of 2021, there would be 377,000 deaths. And so we have, you know, this terrible catastrophe, the biggest catastrophe in the world. It's been going on for 7 years. I mean, what's going on in Ukraine? You know, we all regret the war, but it's a war of a month, which has nothing in the range of casualties in comparison to Yemen. How is it going to affect the other countries in the region? Well, I think that you could see, for one thing, and just in Saudi Arabia itself, is that the attacks that took place on the anniversary of the beginning of the war 7 years ago were the most extensive, I believe, that have been carried out since the war began. So instead of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, with the backing of the U.S. and the U.K. and others, other Western powers, instead of them going forward, they're going backwards. They're losing momentum. And what the consequences of this will be in the long run is very hard to tell. But I think it was quite shocking, the attacks that took place today. It must have been a shock to those in Saudi Arabia that this could happen. But at the same time, we see this intersecting with the Ukraine war, with the Russia-Ukraine war, particularly impacting Yemen, where the reports are that food prices have gone up 150% just in recent weeks. And these are countries that are highly dependent on wheat from Ukraine and Russia for basic foodstuffs. So, you know, what we see unfolding at this moment, I think, in regard to the wars, is that they are moving in directions which are very, very hard for anyone to accurately predict.
Mr. Abu Haiti, leading up to the 7th anniversary of the war, the Yemeni army launched major operations against the Saudis. In the past hours alone, there's been a major coordinated assault on multiple vital facilities across Saudi Arabia. Talk to us about the significance of these retaliatory attacks that have been carried out by the Yemenis. How much have these reprisal attacks changed the dynamics of the war?
I think we've seen that since Yemeni army a few weeks ago started an operation called Breaking the Siege, we've seen that the Saudi has been trying, as they say, to call for peace, and they said that they are patient. They want peace to be kept in Yemen, and they are calling what they say the party of the war to Riyadh. If we see at the beginning of the war, it was totally the opposite. Sana'a used to put many initiatives that they are ready to stop the war. They are ready to have a ceasefire if the Saudi will do the same. But at this point, Saudi is just trying to use the media to deceive the international community that they want to have peace. But we've seen those latest attacks that Yemeni army, as they said many times before, that they are focusing now on Saudi major oil infrastructure and power station and as well water treatment plant, because they said if the Saudi will not lift their siege on Yemen, they have been searching, actually, Saudi, they are searching all the ships that head toward Hudaydah, especially fuel ships. They are searched by the United Nations, but still Saudi keeping fuel out of Yemen by blocking and seizing those oil tanker. That's why Yemeni army now is focusing on Saudi oil infrastructure. If you are not allowing oil and fuel to enter Yemen, we're going to burn out all your oil field. We've seen the latest attack has targeted areas in Ras Tanura, east Saudi Arabia, and as well in Jeddah, west of Saudi Arabia, targeting Aramco infrastructure, as well targeting Jizan and Najran and Abha and Khamis Mashid, south Saudi Arabia, by hitting Aramco installation and some, what they say, vital installation south of Saudi Arabia. This exactly shows that now Yemeni have the upper hand. And I believe, and I've said this many times, if Yemeni will continue those type of attack every week or on a daily basis and focus on this oil, Saudi oil infrastructure, I'm sure at that point that the United States and UK, especially with the war in Ukraine, that they will actually end this war and they will lift the blockade, because they don't want to get any more fuel shortages, because what will hurt Saudi bad is the fuel, and as well, this is the exact thing to the United States and as well to UK and other Western countries.
Richard Becker, Saudi Arabia, it has a far stronger military. It's received billions of dollars worth of arms from the likes of the United States and the UK and other Western countries, of course. After 7 years, it still hasn't won this war against the Ansarullah, which is far less equipped. Why have the Saudis failed so far?
Well, you know, I actually do question how strong the Saudi military is. It's strong in the sense that it has lots of gear, lots of equipment from the U.S., lots of planes and missiles and all of that. But it really can't function without the ongoing support of the U.S., the maintenance of the planes, the training that goes on, and militaries that are created by regimes like the Saudi regime, or, you know, the ones that the U.S. has set up in so many countries, or has done jointly with regimes like the Saudi regime, they tend to not do well in actual wars. They don't have they're not motivated by so much, you know, the dedication to whatever the cause is at that moment as they are to their own careers. And they know that they're, you know, in puppet armies or I wouldn't call the Saudi military a puppet military, but it's one that's highly dependent on the United States. The war could not go on without the support that the United States has given and the weaponry that it's poured in and continues to pour in. And it's really, I think that your other commentator is correct in pointing out that, you know, this comes at a moment when world oil and gas supplies are contracting, and the U.S. is looking urgently for other sources. They're even talking to Venezuela and talking to other countries that have been on its hit list. So this is really something. This is a big development that's happened today, and it will be very interesting to see how the conflict now unfolds and what Washington does.
Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, our guest in San Francisco, mentioned the United States. I want to get your opinion on the U.S.'s involvement in this war. Three U.S. administrations, and they only escalated the war with arms supplies and political support. For the Saudi coalition, U.S. President Joe Biden, of course, pledged an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Ukraine, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war, which did not happen, in fact, at all. Does Washington even want this war to end?
No, I mean, I don't think that they want it to end. We remember that the war was declared by Mr. Al-Jubair, who used to be Saudi ambassador in Washington. And I think this is kind of the first time that a country like Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, declare a war against the other country from a third country. And we've seen that at the first minute of the declaration of the war from Saudi ambassador in Washington, United States has released, the White House has released a statement saying that they will fully support this war, either logistic or by information and as well weapons. And during the war on Yemen, United States, especially during Obama, has struck the largest deal in U.S. History. They show you that they have made billions, hundreds of billions of dollars in profit. The same thing in the U.K. The sales of weapons has increased during the war on Yemen by 500%. But of course, we have seen Biden during his election campaign, he was promising that he will end the war, and he was kind of sending kind of threat that the Saudi should not be, continue their war against Yemen. This is all what happened all the time in the in the U.S. You see those kind of promises. Just as soon as he entered the White House, Saudi has actually tightened their blockade with the support of the United States. We have had now at this point the longest fuel shortages for almost now 1 year since Biden was sworn in as president, because I believe that they might have to come to a conclusion that it's hard to win military. That's why they have tried to use the humanitarian disaster that they have created in Yemen as a weapon. They thought that Yemenis will revolt against Sana'a government. They totally forgot that Yemenis will actually fight to defeat Saudi war against Yemen. And if the United States will be hit hard by targeting the oil infrastructure in Saudi Arabia, I'm sure that they are the one who will be willing to stop this war. That's why now the upper hand is for the Yemeni army, and they should continue on this attack, because now they are the one who bear full responsibility of all civilians that has been killed or will be killed by Saudi Arabia, because they can now actually stop this war by targeting Saudi Arabia.
And Mr. Bohati, I want to stay with you for this next question. The Yemen war is now, as we know, spreading to the UAE. The Yemeni army has attacked multiple targets in the Emirates with drone and missile attacks. The UAE claimed it withdrew most of its forces from Yemen in 2019, but it's still heavily enmeshed in this war. Is the UAE's intervention worth the downside of missile attacks that threaten its tourism industry and could also discourage foreign investment?
I think the United Arab Emirates' role in Yemen is like dirtier than the Saudis, because they actually have created new group to separate Yemen. They have been openly supporting Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Is exactly this is what the Saudi is doing. They want to occupy many important area in Yemen, like Bab al-Mandeb Strait and as well Socotra Island. And now they have openly a relation with the Zionist state of Israel, and they have been speaking clearly that Israel is really interested in those area that's under the control of United Arab Emirates. That's why I believe Yemeni army, they will continue the attack and against United Arab Emirates. And as well, there are the statement from Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi today. He have said that we have done a great deal of work to develop the naval forces. And it just United Arab Emirates must remember that when Yemeni army have seized the ship in the Red Sea, a military ship, they could now at this point seize all Saudi oil tanker and as well United Arab oil tanker.
Right.
Unless if they're not stopping the blockade, this attacks will continue against them.
And let's get a final thought in from Mr. Richard Becker as we wrap up the show. There are wars that the Western countries advocate and support, like Yemen, and there's wars that they condemn and denounce, like Ukraine. Both wars, they result in civilian casualties, destruction of infrastructure. Why do we see this difference in approach? Are the reactions defined on the basis of political alliances rather than the death and destruction that these wars cause?
Well, of course, the Western media, the U.S. media, for instance, becomes the state media at times of war. They all march in lockstep. And then it's so they're reflecting those interests. And then the level of racism is truly appalling. I mean, you have CBS foreign correspondent Dagata, Charlie Dagata, a few weeks ago saying that it isn't a place, Ukraine isn't a place with all due respect like Iraq or Afghanistan. It's a relatively civilized, relatively European, I have to choose the words carefully too, country where one wouldn't expect that. I mean, amazing. This guy says, I chose my words carefully, and he's clearly calling Iraq and Afghanistan countries that are of a lesser standing. And I'm sure he means the same thing about Yemen. So we've had extremely distorted, extremely racist coverage, racism that's been reflected in the coverage of Ukraine vis-a-vis, for instance, Yemen.
All right. Thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for this program. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, Yemeni activist and political commentator, joining us from Sana'a, and Richard Becker from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco.
Beautiful Nowruz customs in Iran. In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has its roots in thousands of years ago. Islam respected Nowruz feast, although it rejected superstitions that had been added to it. Furthermore, Islam approves of happiness, but it tries to omit sinful acts from ceremonies and blend every feast and ceremony with remembrance of God and admonishment. In this episode, we are going to talk more about Nowruz traditions in different regions of Iran. Hope you'll enjoy it. The last Iranian month of Esfand is famous for busy bazaars and malls as people rush for buying Nowruz-related items. Everyone wants to make a change in their life. People in different cities and villages of Iran set a tablecloth called haftsin, meaning seven items beginning with the Farsi letter sin, corresponding with S in English. These items include somar, or sumac, symbolizing life and vividness. Serke, or vinegar, symbolizing patience. Sir, or garlic, symbolizing health and disinfection. Senjed, or oleaster fruit, symbolizing love and rationality. Sib, or apple, symbolizing health and beauty. Samanu, or fresh wheat shoots, pudding, symbolizing sweetness of life, and sabze, or green sprouts of wheat, peas, or lentils, symbolizing freshness, revival, and rebirth. However, it is also believed that sekke, or coin, is also an item in haftsin tablecloth. Moreover, the adherents of Nowruz culture often put other items in the tablecloth, such as colorful eggs, a mirror, a copy of the Noble Quran, and redfish. Many people in various cities of Iran prepare homemade cookies and sweets for Nowruz. Exchange of visits, as an important means of training, plays an important role in the Islamic lifestyle. This Islamic custom is very significant in reinforcing family bonds and social reform, basically keeping and strengthening bonds with relatives has been highly recommended in the Quran and remarks of Prophet Muhammad and his infallible successors' blessings of God upon them. This highly recommended custom is manifested in material, spiritual, emotional, and psychological helps. Islam has highly stressed family bonds. God says in verse 3 of chapter Nisa, "Worship Allah and do not ascribe any partners to him and be good to parents." Iranians since old times have been accustomed to exchanging of visits and gathering together. During Nowruz, younger ones often pay a visit to the elderly, as they consider it as a means of acquiring divine blessing. Thus, the grandmothers and grandfathers usually give their grandchildren and children money called AD. According to the Islamic narrations, visiting a brother in faith equals visiting God on his throne. If a faithful solves a problem of his brother in faith, God will solve 70 problems of him on the Day of Judgment. Another nice custom in Nowruz is to make peace between brothers and friends. Islam has highly stressed to give up spites and grudges and reconcile. A famous hadith reads that if two faithful brothers are spiteful toward each other for 3 consecutive days, the spirit of faith will leave them and their worship will not be accepted. In view of this, some people try to act as go-between to make peace between their brothers. Once Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said to his companions, "Do you want me to inform you of something better than prayer and fasting?" They said, "Yes, Messenger of Mercy." The Prophet said, "Reconciliation with each other." One of the best ways to spend one's leisure time in Islam is to travel. There are many verses in the Quran which invite people to travel all over the earth to see the signs of God everywhere. Traveling to different places causes us to understand better the realities of creation and to be admonished. For instance, verse 20 of chapter Ankabut reads, "Say, travel over the land and then observe how he has originated the creation. Then Allah shall bring about the genesis of the hereafter. Indeed, Allah has power over all things." The human spirit gets bored of everyday works and it needs renewal of energy and vividness. The arrival of spring and Nowruz festivities provide humans the opportunity to travel and entertain. Entertainment makes the spirit sprightly and helps us pursue our goals in life better. Traveling naturally brings about happiness. This is one of the greatest blessings of traveling. Human psyche and thought grow and thrive through communications. Human beings get familiar with different cultures and traditions via traveling. Traveling adds to one's knowledge too. Well, time is over for this episode. Next time, we will continue our discussion on Nowruz. God bless you.
if you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.